A fascinating social and sporting experiment's been going on in Florida for the past 2 months. The National Basketball Association, NBA, has been spending an estimated $180 million to create an isolation zone, the 2020 NBA bubble at Walt Disney World near Orlando. Since July, players and support staff from a dwindling number of teams have been staying there as they complete the regular season and the playoffs. Ben Golliver is the Washington Post's NBA writer correspondent who's been staying in the NBA bubble since day one, some 70-odd days ago, and is now writing a book called Bubble Ball, all about the experience. We spoke to him yesterday from his hotel room at Disney World. I asked him why the bubble had been set up in Florida, a state that's been hit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, because of the relationship between NBA, ESPN, which is one of its major media partners, and the Walt Disney Company, which owns Walt Disney World Resort, which happens to be in Orlando, Florida. I mean, this was a situation where the NBA was faced with really a billion-dollar problem. When the novel coronavirus hit, they could not play their games in stadiums in front of fans. They needed to find a way to salvage the season. Every single year that the NBA has existed, they have crowned a champion. And so this was really a fundamental crisis for the league, not only from a need to generate revenue, but to also provide closure to the players for the season. So they started to scramble and brainstorm and decide, well, you know, what kind of a place could house 22 teams, more than 1,500 people, coaches, media members, and everything else, and where can you do it safely to kind of seal it off from the outside world? They considered Las Vegas, which is home to the NBA's annual Summer League tournament, but ultimately they decided they needed some place even more secure with kind of stricter borders and just a more controlled and contained environment, and they settled on Walt Disney World and the ESPN Sports Complex, here on campus. They used three different arenas. They used three different hotels. They turned a whole bunch of ballrooms into practice facilities, and they created their own little world or their own little planet right here in Central Florida. You mentioned how it was a big hotspot throughout the summer. The NBA's protocols, their rules and regulations, which require masks and social distancing, have created an environment where not a single person who has entered the bubble has tested positive for the coronavirus over the course of more than 2 months, and games have continued with no issues. So their careful planning has paid off.
Let's talk about the rigidity of the processes to protect all those within the bubble. What does that look like? What is being done to ensure, and it's obviously working, so what is being done to ensure that the virus doesn't appear within the bubble itself?
Well, first things first, everybody has to go through a quarantine period. So as a media member, I went through a 7-day quarantine period inside my hotel room as soon as I got here. So that meant no outside contact with anybody for any reason. During that time period, the only human contact I had was actually with test takers who would come to my front door and administer coronavirus tests with the swab in my nose and in the back of my throat. I had to pass 7 consecutive tests over the course of a week before they would sort of release me into the wider campus. And then I also have to fill out every single day a questionnaire, whether I have any symptoms, whether I've come into contact with anyone who tests positive. I have to also provide a temperature reading and a pulse oximeter reading every single morning that they add to their database to just kind of check as an early warning sign, for the possible exposure to the virus. In addition to that, we are heavily credentialed. You know, the actual campus is restricted in terms of where we can go and not go. The players are actually kept in a bubble inside the bubble. So a lot of the areas they spend their most time, media members and other staff members just don't have access to. In addition to the credentials, we also wear proximity alarms, which help enforce social distancing. So if I happen to stand too close to somebody else who also has a proximity alarm, it will start to beep like a smoke detector, and that will be our cue that we need to step away. For meals, we are encouraged to social distance, especially if we're indoors. The tables are all set up to basically at individual eating stations. Masks are mandatory everywhere on campus unless you're exercising by yourself, away from everybody else. And then in terms of, other basic hygiene, they've got, disinfecting wipes pretty much everywhere you could want them. When we go to the arenas, we sit in socially distanced seats in the media section. The player benches are also socially distanced. The players are required to wear masks in all of their interviews, or you know, at least encouraged to wear them during their interviews. But anytime they're not playing, or they're in transit to and from games, they have to wear masks. Or if they walk around on campus, they also have to wear masks. I mean, the list of rules just goes on and on and on. You know, no overnight guests, no outside food delivery services. Those kinds of things will wind up getting you the need to re-quarantine for up to 10 days if you try to, basically break the rules. And they monitor this stuff very carefully. There's multiple layers of law enforcement, including Disney security, local police, local county sheriffs, NBA security itself, and then video surveillance around the campus to make sure there are no people coming and going. So you add that all up and you can understand it's been a very rigorous and rigid environment to live in. I've been here now for 74 days, so this has become almost like my new normal. And by the way, I get a coronavirus test every single morning as well. And if I don't get tested, then I'm not allowed to attend games. So you add all that up, you could tell that they've planned this thing very thoroughly and carefully. And like I said earlier, it's paid off.
Wow. That's full on.
No, they're not playing games here at all.
No,
look,
no.
Here's the thing. They look at it like this. If LeBron were to test positive, that's like a $500 million mistake, right? Because that just means he can't play in games and your television ratings go down the tube. So I think that they started from the premise of we have some, you know, legitimate money-making players, and not only just from the revenue-generating standpoint, but from the humanity standpoint too. If you're going to put this thing on, everyone needs to feel comfortable and safe. And so they concentrated most of their efforts on keeping the players as safe as possible, understanding that they play an indoor sport and understanding that sport is full contact. So, you know, by its very nature, basketball is actually a pretty risky activity for the spread of the coronavirus. And that's why you have to go above and beyond on all these other things to make sure you're able to host these games safely.
Was it due to the fact that, and I think you interviewed Utah Jazz's Rudy Gobert, who is considered to be patient zero. Is the rigidity and the robustness due to the fact that the NBA was one of the first to stop their competition? Was because of Rudy? Was because of what happened in that press conference? Is that one of the motivating reasons why the NBA has been so robust and rigid around its processes now?
Well, I think one of the biggest reasons why is the influence the NBA players have relative to the overall operation of the sport. In baseball and football, the relationships between the unions and the league offices are much more strained. In the NBA, because it's such a superstar-driven sport and because there's just fewer players, it winds up being more of a partnership between the players and the owners. So they negotiated all these rules out over the course of multiple months, and they really wanted to make sure that if they did it, they did it right. They didn't want to come down here into a situation where one person gets it, winds up exposing, you know, three or four teams worth of players, and they have to shut down and go home. They wanted to, you know, make sure that because they were in the middle of their season and trying to, you know, complete a championship chase, they knew they had to get it right. It wasn't like baseball, which is starting fresh with the new year, or football that's starting fresh, or even college football, which is starting fresh as well. They had a lot at stake, and they didn't have the potential to, like, push pause and delay things if they got sidetracked from a health standpoint. I think also the players, you know, are so well compensated in the NBA, you had to make it worth their while to come down to the bubble, right? If you're saying, oh, yeah, we're not really going to take this too seriously, there's a lot of guys who would look around and say, you know what? I make $25 million. I don't want to expose myself to coronavirus risk. I can just stay home with my family. If you don't pay me, fine. That's cool with me. And there actually were some NBA players who decided to opt out of the bubble for health and safety reasons. So I think a big part of the pitch to the players from the league was, we're going to make this first class all the way. You're going to be safe. You're going to have the best hotels that we can find for you in Disney World. We're going to give you a really good court facility to play high stakes games. And then also on areas of like social justice or campaigning on behalf of police violence victims, we're going to make sure that, you know, your voices are heard, that we're going to support you on those fronts as well. I think all of those things factored into the NBA's approach on how they built the bubble.
There has been talk from players about dealing with cabin fever. How have you dealt with that?
It's a great question. Well, first of all, I'm a lot dorkier than a lot of the players, okay? So my needs are not really on the same needs as the players. So first of all, I just keep myself busy from a work standpoint. I do podcasts every single day. I'm writing every single night. So that fills up a lot of my time. In terms of how to find balance, I go for a walk every single afternoon. Now that we have a fewer games because we're almost through the playoffs, I'm able to kind of extend that. So usually I'm walking about 6 miles a day. There's all sorts of interesting outdoor nature activity here. So I've seen crocodiles, I guess I should say alligators. I've seen a long snake. I've seen butterflies. I've seen heron. I've seen snake birds. I mean, all sorts of fun, wildlife and flowers. And I've been here so long, the seasons have actually changed. So we started in a really hot and humid summer, and now it's cooling off here a little bit for fall. Beyond that, I also bought myself a really fancy Lego Lamborghini set, which took me pretty much 2 months to build because I was just working on it off and on. So that was my pride and joy. I have this, it's probably like a 2.5 foot long Lego Lamborghini car that I actually had to ship home because I just finished it. So that was one of my pursuits. But look, for me, this was a business trip. I'm coming down here, almost out of hibernation. We didn't have anything to talk about or write about for 4 months. So now I'm in a situation where I can go to every single basketball game, every playoff game since the second round on. I've been in attendance at it and covered. It's just an unbelievable experience for, a basketball junkie like myself. I'm never going to be in a situation where I can cover every single playoff series simultaneously like I have been here in the bubble. When it goes back to normal, you're going to go back to how we usually do it, which is you pick one playoff series and you cover that one and you kind of watch the rest from afar. And so for me, it's been just an amazing opportunity. You know, in any given day, you could see Giannis, LeBron, Kawhi Leonard all playing back to back to back. And that's pretty special.
Ben, I don't mean to come across as derogatory, but the Lamborghini set thing is dorky. But let's move on. The competition itself, as a sports event for television, has the bubble worked?
Yes, as well as they could have hoped. Look, I mean, you got to remember, you're not comparing their ratings that they're getting right now to what you would get for your normal ratings, because ultimately you're putting games on in the middle of the summer. You are putting them on in some cases at weird times just because you have to fit so many games in. So not every game is prime time. Some of the start times are afternoon start times. And then also, you're up against different competition. I mean, usually the NBA pretty much dominates the American sports cycle in June for the finals. And when they start the finals here in October, they're going against baseball, football, college football, and all sorts of other stuff, right? So the ratings are going to suffer from that standpoint compared to quote-unquote normal. But remember, you're actually comparing it to zero, because when they had nothing on television, they were generating no revenue. They're already taking a 40% revenue hit, which is multiple billions of dollars, by not being able to have fans in the arenas. So I think from that standpoint, any television revenue was good television revenue, and it ultimately more than paid for the bubble experience, by a factor of 10, probably.
What about the quality of the games, Ben?
Completely surprising. Look, I came in with very low expectations. I spent a month telling anybody who would listen, oh, this is going to be ugly basketball. These guys are probably going to be out of shape or working themselves back into shape. I mean, just think about what would you be doing during the pandemic? You're just trying to stay healthy. You're not out there, working yourself like crazy. And instead, it was exactly the opposite. The guys came here, hit the ground running. Now, maybe some of these teams weren't so excited about playing defense, okay? We had a number of shootouts, high-scoring games in the 130s and 140s. But by the time the playoffs start, teams were very locked in, and we got some fascinating matchups. I mean, head-to-head duels where guys were scoring 50 points back and forth. We saw some upsets with both the Milwaukee Bucks and the Los Angeles Clippers, who were two of the top three contenders, go out early. And then you've seen phenomenal play from the LA Lakers and LeBron James, who's sort of the sport's signature star right now. They're competing to try to return to the finals, which would be a huge story for the NBA as well. So you add all that up, I think it's been pleasantly surprising. And I think the biggest surprise of all is that the lack of crowds, it's definitely different in these gyms. I mean, it's quiet. It's very weird. Sometimes it feels a little bit eerie. But if you do have those amazing buzzer-beating type moments where OG Anunoby hits an amazing shot for the Toronto Raptors, or Anthony Davis hits a game winner this week against the Denver Nuggets, there is still a genuine thrill and excitement in the building. The players and the bench and the coaches are the ones who are sort of leading those celebrations. But still, you get the goosebumps. And I think for people at home who are watching, they've done a really nice job of creating a television set almost for these games, so that it does feel like, you know, as close to normal as possible. You're seeing video boards, you're seeing virtual fans, you're not seeing empty seats. And I think that was a really smart and shrewd decision by the NBA when they constructed this entire premise.
You're listening to Ben Golliver, reporter, sports reporter, NBA reporter for the Washington Post, on RNZ National with Julian Wilcox. Ben, has it helped players, and you've written about three-point players. I saw your story on Jamal Murray, actually, and the way he played in Game 2 and in the recent Game 3 as well. Has it helped those point guards, and in particularly those three-point shooters? Has the style of the game, has bubble ball helped those players develop themselves to become stars in these series?
Well, here, I think that the biggest factor in terms of the quality of play has been the absence of travel. I mean, the NBA travel schedule is ridiculous. And, you know, during a typical playoff, just as a writer, I will usually put on about 15 pounds because it's so hard to sleep and because I'm changing time zones and because it's just nonstop. And I'm a writer, you know, like I don't actually have to go out there and put in the hard work of playing, right? So that's over the course of a couple month period. Now, you look at the players, you know, they're traveling back and forth, sometimes three or four flights within a series. They cram these things in, so you don't have very much rest time or off days. Sometimes they're not arriving into markets until 4 a.m., and they have to change multiple time zones while they do that. You could understand how that kind of a fatigue factor would become overwhelming and accumulate over the course of the playoffs. And by the time you get to the end of it, maybe guys aren't shooting as well. Maybe the energy isn't quite as high and all the rest of it. Now, here in the bubble, not only do you not have to travel anywhere, you just get to go back and forth, short, convenient trips from the hotel to the arena. It's the same arena every single night, the same sight lines. There's no crowd trying to distract you. There's no outside noise. And so if you're a real grinder, if you're a basketball junkie like a Jamal Murray, this is an ideal setup, right? This is your time to shine. You can just stay in a rhythm basically for a month straight, as he has. And you're seeing him shoot almost 50% on three-pointers for the playoffs. That's an unheard-of number. I mean, only like Steph Curry could probably even come close to that in NBA history, given how often he's shooting. And I think a big part of why is just the circumstantial factors here at the bubble. Now, at the same time, this experience is not for everybody. There was definitely some teams who were really excited to get out of here. They didn't like the isolation. They didn't like all the time they had to spend together. If your team had some chemistry issues internally, those would show through very quickly in this bubble environment. So I'm thinking of teams like the Philadelphia 76ers and the Houston Rockets, who both got out of here, you know, before the end of the second round. In those kinds of situations, I think the bubble actually worked against them. It hurt more than it helped.
Can that also, do you think, protect and defend Doc Rivers and the LA Clippers, who essentially choked in their series, right? They were up by they're up to three and choked in the and went down 4-3 in the end. And there has been talk that Doc Rivers, who as you know is an iconic coach within the NBA, do you think that that will protect him and he will stand his job, because this could be seen as a quote unquote asterisk season?
Yeah, I think that for the Clippers, they just had a lot of moving parts. I mean, they had two players who had to leave the bubble due to funerals. And that cost them, obviously, a lot of time preparing together. They had one of their key players get injured, and he was kind of dealing with that nagging injury while he was here. You had, I think, in general, they had never really put together their internal team chemistry because they had so many new players and new superstar players in Kawhi Leonard and Paul George coming into this season. And so while they tried their best to kind of, you know, learn everything on the fly, having a four-month shutdown and then an abbreviated ramp-up period where not everybody was available really hurt them, for sure. I do think that Doc Rivers is probably on safe ground. He has a lot of internal credibility within that organization. He's carried them through some really tough times. But this season was absolutely a disappointment for them. And they do enter next season again with championship or bust expectations. I mean, that's what happens when you trade away as many draft picks as they did and as many young players as they did to get Paul George. That team absolutely wants to win now. The owner has spent an unbelievable amount of money, a small fortune, to put this organization in position to win, and he's going to want results.
Ben, we heard players talking after Jacob Blake was shot in Wisconsin about not just about standing down from games, but some even threatening to leave the competition. With the recent decision handed down by the grand jury in the case of Breonna Taylor, do you think that could impact
current players who are in the final series? Could we see players leave the competition? And obviously, given protests that are happening across America now?
Well, it was definitely a question on our mind yesterday. Would they play the game? Because the news came out just hours before the Eastern Conference Finals Game 4, and there had been players outspoken on both the Miami Heat and the Boston Celtics trying to find justice or support justice for Breonna Taylor's family. Now, they ultimately went ahead with the game. I think a big factor why is because a lot of the players were bracing for that bad news. They just sort of expected that the cops would not be charged. And it had taken so long for there to really be any action in the case. They had sort of already resigned themselves to the worst case scenario. And a number of players spoke to that effect after the game. I think that that was probably the critical difference between the Jacob Blake situation and the Breonna Taylor situation was the matter of timing. Jacob Blake was shot just, days before the players decided to shut things down. Whereas Breonna Taylor has been on all these players' minds for months. You know, I like to say LeBron James has been the number one name in the bubble, and I think Breonna Taylor has been number two. I mean, that's how long these guys have been committed to, her cause and trying to get justice. So I think from that standpoint, the games will continue. I think you will hear and continue to hear NBA players speaking about the situation. There's really no question about it. I think this one really struck home to a lot of players because she was defenseless in her own house. If you're not safe in your own bed, where are you safe? And I think, we've heard LeBron James use some language like, NBA players feel hunted almost by police officers and black people around the country feel hunted, based on the United States relationship with firearms. That's very strong words. And I think that, that sentiment is really, derived from the Breonna Taylor situation. Now, in terms of, whether that shutdown was going to last, remember, these guys gave up an awful lot. They stayed down here a long time to kind of make these playoffs happen. And they are basketball players. That's their profession. They want to see a champion crown just as much as the fans do. And so I do expect that this competition will stay on course and that they'll be able to crown a champion here. The bottom line is we're only a couple weeks away from the finish line. The campus right now kind of feels like a ghost town. We're down to four teams. We started with 22. There's probably about a third the number of total people who are here as there was when they first started. So I think from that standpoint, the players are just trying to gut through to the finish line.
It's been an extraordinary season, hasn't it? And you have said, actually, that 2020 is one of the most pivotal years for the NBA. And we've just talked about Jacob Blake and Breonna Taylor, the COVID-19 pandemic. Is that why you've called this the most pivotal season? Or is it also due to the fact that the game could have actually been lost and really affected by a loss of revenue if this postseason hadn't occurred? Was that also the motivating factor behind what you said?
Absolutely. I think when you look at this year, there's just so many layers to it. Remember, it started with a gigantic controversy and a very expensive controversy between the NBA and China over human rights violations and protesters in Hong Kong. You go from that to the death of Kobe Bryant, one of the most iconic players and beloved players by fans in Los Angeles in NBA history. You have the passing of David Stern, arguably the most influential commissioner in the history of the sport. Then you have the coronavirus shutdown, which threatens the sport's finances like nothing else before it. I mean, billions of dollars at stake. And also the symbolic value of whether or not you're going to be able to crown a champion. You throw all of that together with sort of the ingenuity of the bubble concept, the fact that the players were willing to commit to it, the fact that a number of stars who were living very comfortable lives decided to move into random hotels at Disney World and try to compete for a title as if they were like, 12-year-old AAU players all over again. I mean, all of those things, whether it's finance, whether it's the emotions, whether it's the social justice issues with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, and all the rest of it, all of that just adds a real weight and a gravity to what's happened here in 2020. And I think, American history, factors into play here too. It also happens to be a presidential election season. You see a number of players, including LeBron James, being very, very vocal about voter advocacy, sign up, whatever they could do to help people, become franchised, right, and to have a chance to vote. The players have been in the forefront of that as well. I think that it's just been a turning point type year for these players. Obviously, they're predominantly African-American. They're approaching these issues from that perspective. They are shaping the discourse in American society around issues like police violence and voting rights and voting access. And so from that standpoint, the bigger than basketball cliche gets thrown around constantly here in the bubble, but that's absolutely what it's been. And I think, from the health, from the finances, from the social justice and all of it, 2020 is unlike any year that I've covered, and including the tragedy, too, by the way, with Kobe Bryant and David Stern. It's unlike any year I've covered in the 13 years I've covered the sport. And I think it's going to absolutely be remembered as one of like the five most important years in the league's history.
Will the champion, the eventual champion, ever be really referred to as the true champion of the 2020 season? Or will they have an asterisk beside their name simply because of what has happened this year, particularly with COVID?
Well, I like to split the difference. I like to think that whoever wins this thing will be known as the bubble champions for all time, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an asterisk, but it just means that it was a little bit different, right? They're the team that went down to Disney World and came out on top. I think ultimately, like, these teams have been tested so much and the competition has been at such a high level, and you did have such great, extraordinary play from some of the game's biggest stars while they were here, that I do think that the eventual champion will be validated. I really believe that. Now, if it's an upset, a team like Denver or, something like that, okay, well, maybe people might say, all right, that never would have happened in a normal year. And maybe there would be a little bit of asterisk talk there. But I think overall, the product has lived up to expectations, especially for hardcore basketball fans. And so from that standpoint, I don't think the asterisk will be applied in a negative way. I actually think people will just say, oh, yeah, the 2020 Lakers, they were the bubble champs, right? That's how it's going to be remembered.
Ben, we've heard that Adam Silver has said that he thinks next season's competition will start in January. And if they go for a full season of 82 games, will that not have an impact on teams and players for the Olympics next year? And therefore, we may not see a full dream team. You may see players like Ben Simmons be effective for the Australian Boomers when they go over to the Olympics. Will that happen, do you think?
It's very possible. I mean, look, I think that they're going to want to play as many games as possible in front of as many fans as possible in as many markets as possible, because that's what drives the revenue, right? So as I mentioned earlier, about 40% of the NBA's revenue comes from arena related, whether it's ticket sales or parking or merchandise or, food and beverage, all that stuff. So the NBA, that's going to be their focus. Now, sending their players for free to go play in the Olympics, that's way down the pecking order, unfortunately. And I think that's going to put the NBA in a situation where they're going to build their calendar based on what generates the most revenue. Now, I think there's also going to be some hesitation from players, I would imagine. Do they want to be traveling overseas so quickly after the pandemic, or is there going to be some reluctance? And also, are they just exhausted from the bubble experience? Are they just exhausted from a quick turnaround into another season next year, even if it doesn't start until January? I do think that, recruitment efforts for every national team are going to be much more difficult if they involve NBA players, because this has been a very exhausting experience for all parties involved. And I wouldn't be surprised, by the way, if a lot of the biggest stars, the American stars, even if they are able to attend, if they just decide not to.
That was the Washington Post's NBA writer Ben Golliver speaking to us from the NBA bubble in Florida. Ben's book Bubble Ball is due out in May 2021.